I want to start this evening with Romans chapter 2. I'm not at all able to survey the entire content of the book that's back there. I'm going to try to hit the high points. If some of it seems like it's left undone afterwards, we'll handle the questions with that. But I want to start with Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, because I will be leaning on that a bit heavily in formulating the thesis. Romans 2:14, "For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing, or else excusing one another." Now, as he said, I'll be dealing with the book, The Continuing Relevance of Divine Law. What I try to do in that book is establish a couple of things. One, that there is a distinction between the law of God, the law of Moses, and the law of Christ. We'll try to deal with that as we go along. A distinction between the law of God, the law of Moses, and the law of Christ. And then, having done that, what we'll try to do is show that it is the law of Christ that is binding on the New Covenant believer. Now, I've put on your outline some competing systems here. Covenant theology, of course, with its emphasis on the unity of God's unfolding plan of redemption, stresses the idea of unity through the Scripture, and with that, there is a strong tendency to carry over the old order into the new. With that, then, you have the church becomes Israel, and we've talked about that earlier this evening. And also with that, and this is what we're going to deal with, is there is a strong tendency to carry over law from the old order into the new order. Now, on the other extreme, we've got dispensational theology, which has a stress on God's changes in his dealings with his people and the differences, the discontinuity between the old order and the new order. For them, law entirely, for traditional dispensationalism, law is a thing of the past. Now, so in covenant theology, with their idea of law being carried over into the new order from the old, dispensationalists have tended to call them legalists. With dispensationalists saying, no, there is no more law, the people on the other side tend to call the dispensationalists antinomian. Now, what I'm going to do is try to establish a third view. And I've not often been accused of being a humble person, but at least believe me when I say this is a humble attempt to establish a third position, which can try to work within the other systems. And hopefully we won't be antinomian, and hopefully we won't be legalists either. You can see the tension between the two systems. But I've tried to deal with what I think forms the essence of what we've tried to call, some of us have tried to call, New Covenant theology. I take exception to dispensationalism's approach when it says there is no more law on today's believer, on the New Covenant believer. But I agree with dispensationalism when it says the law of Moses is not carried over into this dispensation. On the other hand, I have to take exception, I think, to traditional covenant theology when it says the law of Moses is carried over, but yet I agree with it when it says that the law that there is some law carried over into this age and the believer is bound to law in this dispensation. So that's kind of what we are going to be working with. The specific area of study, law is used in several senses in Scripture, several different ways. What we are focusing on this evening is law as a rule of life. Law as a rule of life. This is the so-called third use of the law, as it was stated in the Formula of Concord. Okay, to do that, now we have to start with law before Moses. Law before Moses. First of all, the fact of it. John tells us, law came by Moses. But I don't think that is intended to deny that law existed previously, previous to Moses. Part of the justification we have for saying that is in here in Romans chapters 1 and 2. Paul here, as you know, is condemning the entire world for its universal rejection of God and disobedience. But that condemnation of the world is premised on, if you'll see it in verse 19 of chapter 1, It's premised on their rejection of the truth that is in them. This is what Cornelius Van Til and others, I guess, have called the sensus deitatis, this innate knowledge of God. I think we would all agree to that. There is in man, in his constitution, some innate knowledge of God. But what's significant in this passage, throughout Romans 1 and 2, there are some indications that this knowledge of God implies at least a basic sense of right and wrong. And our brother was just talking about this a while ago when he goes to those primitive tribes in New Guinea. There is this, no matter how remote the tribe, they have a sense of the basic principles of morality. Now, we know that in verse 18 of chapter 1 because Paul describes their sin as rebellion. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. The picture is there of them sinning in order to suppress their conscience by their more sinning. In fact, when we get to the end of chapter 1 in verse 32, you find that this knowledge of right and wrong is so significant that they have even an innate knowledge of coming judgment for their disobedience to these principles of right and wrong, which they know. And then that brings us to chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, which we began with, where Paul speaks of man's conscience in terms of a law written on their hearts. It seems then what we have is man in the image of God has a basic sense of right and wrong. This is God's law written in their hearts, evidently, at creation. And notice then that this law is distinct from Moses, because Paul says in verse 14, these are the Gentiles who have not the law. They don't have the law of Moses, yet they have a law written on their heart. It seems that this is their rule of life to which they're held accountable. Now, we have some Old Testament intimations of that as well. For instance, in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 16, where God is promising the land to Abraham, you remember he says, you won't get the land yet because their iniquity is not yet full. Well, we come to the time of the judges and it's time for them to take the land. Evidently, then, their iniquity has become full. Now, Moses' law has not been given yet at this point. So what is it that constitutes their iniquity? Well, I think all we can come back to is that they have violated this law written in their heart, their conscience, these basic principles of right and wrong, they have violated. I think we have hints of this as well in the prophets when they, on occasion, would chide the Gentile nations around them for their sin, and they never pull up Moses' law as their basis of condemnation. It seems that they are violating the law written on their heart, this conscience that God has given to them. And again, we have this in chapter 2 and verse 14. They were not given the law, yet they were responsible for their sins. And in chapter 3 and verse 9, when Paul pronounces all under sin, it is not for their violation of the terms of Sinai. It seems it goes back to chapter 1 in verses 18 and 19 for their rejection of the truth that is in them, suppressing their conscience. So, there is this law of God within man. Now, what's not quite as clear is the identity of that law. How do we say exactly what is that law of God published in men's hearts? Well, I think the only way we can establish the identity of that law is to go back to the Old Testament before Moses gave the law at Sinai and find what sins were there that men were held accountable for before Moses. And you go back in that section of Scripture and you find them condemned for sins such as false worship, idolatry, murder, adultery, immorality of various kinds. And you find these sins for which men were held accountable. And you have to say, okay, they knew better apart from Mosaic legislation. This was the law of God in their hearts, which they had rejected. Now, I think what's important to recognize at this point is that each of those sins forbidden before Moses are also forbidden under Moses' law. But it's not Moses who first showed them to be sinful. The two laws seem to be distinct. There seems to be a distinction between them. They were sinful apart from formal legislation against them. They seem to be a violation of the law written in the heart. Now then, what we have to do is establish the relationship of the law of God. And I'm calling this the law of God. And granted, this is not a biblical term per se when I'm speaking of it in this sense. But when I say law of God this evening, this is what I'll have in mind, this law written in the heart. What is the relationship of that law to the law of Moses? Well, the first thing is that you see that they are distinct. They are not the same. The one existed before the other. The one was written in the heart before the other became a formal law that was written in stone. What seems to be then is that the law of God is foundational to the law of Moses. The law of Moses was a particular codification of the law of God that was published in men's heart at creation. The law of God then formed the basis of the Mosaic law, but it was a standard that existed independently. Now then, if you look at the law of God in relation to the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, you'll find that it is nearly identical. The two forbid basically the same things. What seems, again, to be coming from that observation is that Moses' law was simply a particular codification of the law of God given originally at creation that existed previous. To summarize it, the relationship between the law of God and the law of Moses is one of foundation extrapolation. That is, Mosaic legislation is founded upon the law of God, and it makes specific applications from it. That is, it formally stated the principles of divine law that were in men's hearts originally, and then it makes specific applications from it. Now, in doing that, you're going to have more laws than what originally existed. You're going to have specific applications from that law of God. Hence, we have dietary regulations, civil obligations, cultic rituals. We have various kinds of things in the law of Moses which simply were nowhere around before Moses. They are specific applications of the law of God, specific extensions of those principles of righteousness given to a covenant people for a specific purpose, and that seems to be indicating that it's obligatory so long as that covenant relationship is in force. If we have the law of God existing previously, and we have Moses coming along taking it but making specific applications from it in this covenantal relationship, well, then we have this law in force and in relation to people with whom that covenant was made, and obligatory so long as that covenant is in force. So the two laws are neither identical, nor are they altogether different. The one formed the basis of the other, and the second required more than the first, but the two can't be equated absolutely. Now then, we come to the question of the status of Sinai, Mosaic legislation today. The first point here is a summary. This we could spend a long time on, so let me just give you a bulk of material in running course. Listen fast. We won't take time to look up a lot of this now. We'll probably get to some of it later. This seems to me to be a very easy question that the New Testament writers unanimously and repeatedly pronounce on, and that is that the law of Moses is fulfilled in Christ and so set aside. And by that I mean the law of Moses in its entirety. Now, the issue in the early church was a matter of heated dispute. They talked about it all of the time, and so because of that, we have several pronouncements on it, and that's good for us. Generally, the debate centered on matters like circumcision, whether or not it was required under the new covenant, or it was the necessity of law-keeping as a means of justification. These kinds of issues came up. But the answer given was part of a broader principle, and that is that the law of Moses was not binding on the new covenant believer, that it was something that was previous for them. Now, we have that stated in several ways. Paul speaks of Christian liberty, for example. Our brother is going to deal, I think, with Romans 14. The idea in Christian liberty very often in Paul is just this idea that Moses' law is not binding on the new covenant believer. And in fact, in Romans 14, it is the weaker brother who says so. We also have the Moses' law spoken of in the New Testament in the past tense. No longer in effect. In fact, it's spoken of in terms like abolished, wiped out, fulfilled in Christ, and so displaced. It seems to me to be abundantly clear that Moses' law is said so clearly in the New Testament have been set aside. Fulfilled in Christ, and so abolished. Now, here's where we come into some of the problems with covenant theology. Covenant theology has traditionally argued that it is not the law of Moses entirely that has been set aside, but a part of it. And what it has been arguing is what I have here on the board for you. What they've done is divide the law into three parts: moral, ceremonial, and civil law. What they'll say then is when we come to these New Testament statements on the abrogation of Moses' law, they will say, no, what that means is that this is abolished, and this is abolished, but this remains. Well, there's their argument. It seems to me that there are several problems with it, and that's what we're going to deal with here. The first and I think most obvious problem is that the New Testament just never says it quite that way. It says that Moses' law was abolished, and it says it in several terms, but it never says two-thirds of the law was abolished. Now, if you're a Reconstructionist, you believe both this and this remain. It's only this ceremonial law that's abolished. But the New Testament never says it that way either. It says Moses' law was abolished. In fact, Paul seems to be so reckless in his speech that way. Just it came, it served its purpose, and it's gone. It's set aside. That seems to be the most obvious problem with it. In fact, in the New Testament, in fact, in the Old Testament, nowhere can you find any justification for dividing the law this way at all. You can't find Paul, you can't find Peter, Moses, Jesus, any of them speaking in terms of this part of Moses, that part of Moses, and yet another part of Moses. The distinction just doesn't seem to exist. In other words, this whole system of dividing the law and so using that to interpret some other statements seems to be quite arbitrary. It seems to be artificial. They've made the distinction and then they impose it on the scriptures and use that then as an interpretive tool. When Paul says, for example, that the old law is abolished, he doesn't say two parts of the law are abolished or part of the law. He just says the law is abolished. The question I have is, how do we know that he really meant that only that and that's abolished, not this? How do I know that? Now, I know the hermeneutical system that makes me know that, but how do I know it from the text itself? And my point is, I can't find that anywhere. In fact, it seems, and this is the next point in your outline, it seems that this whole thing is self-defeating. For example, most covenant theologians would admit that the civil law is simply an extension of the second table of the moral law. Okay? I think by the same token, the ceremonial law is an extension, an extrapolation of the first table of the moral law. Now, once you start arguing that way, how many laws do you have after all? Do we have three parts or do we have only two? Now, well, it seems to me once you start arguing that way, you've implicitly acknowledged that the law is one whole unit that can't be divided. So it seems to me to be self-defeating. So to take an artificial distinction and use it as an interpretive tool on the scriptures is an illegitimate hermeneutic. I think, for example, I think that the law is in three parts. So when Moses says the law is abolished, I'll interpret that as meaning these two parts abolished, but not this one. Well, you have to have some justification for doing that. And that's what I'm saying I think is difficult to establish. In fact, and I think it gets more plain here even, is that these divisions are exactly contrary to some of the biblical statements. For example, I've alluded to Galatians chapter 3. Paul speaks of the abolition of Moses' law there in so many words. And Paul is just reckless with it. He talks about the law coming in. He speaks of it serving a purpose, and then he speaks of it as no longer needed. Now, I don't see how any covenant theologian could have written that passage, at least without blushing. Paul is just so reckless about it. It came, it served its purpose, it's gone. And you don't see any hint of, well, parts of it remain, but parts of it are gone. You just don't see it at all. And when Paul speaks of the Moses' law as abolished, I think we should take him in the plain sense that it is abolished. In fact, and we won't look at these passages here yet either, we'll get to it, I hope, in a few minutes. The abolition, the New Testament speaks of the abolition of the New Testament, or the Mosaic covenant. Now follow my thinking here. The New Testament speaks in the broadest terms possible when it's speaking of the abolition of Moses. It doesn't just say Moses' law was abolished. It doesn't just say parts of the law. It says the Mosaic covenant was abolished. And that's all of this. It couldn't be plainer. You find that in Hebrews chapters 8 and 9, what John alluded to earlier, where the new covenant has come and displaced the old in the plainest terms possible. You find it in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, where Paul talks about, I am a minister of the new covenant, not of the old. I'm a minister of the new covenant, and this has special advantages to the old. Very plain that it's not just a part of the law. It's not just the law, but the covenant itself. It's the broadest terms possible. Moses' covenant is abolished. Now, if the covenant is abolished, the covenant itself is gone. It is really difficult to see how part of the law of that covenant remains after all. I don't think it will work. Again, turn to Exodus chapter 34. Exodus chapter 34. This, I think, is very telling on it. And that is that the moral law, now keep in mind the distinctions that we're talking about. The moral law, namely the Ten Commandments, okay? What we find here in Exodus 34 is that the moral law is the old covenant. Look at verses 27 and 28. And the Lord said unto Moses, write thou these words, for after the tenor of these words I have made a covenant with thee and with Israel. And he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did neither eat bread nor drink water, and he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. Interesting here. Moses equates, identifies the words of the covenant with the moral law, so-called, the Ten Commandments. In fact, it's God himself who makes the identification here. So the moral law is the old covenant. Now, not only does that demonstrate the inseparable unity of Moses' law, but it is very telling when it comes back to this basic issue that we're working from, and that is when the New Testament writers speak of the abolition of Moses' law, how are we to understand it? Well, if Moses' law, and notice specifically it's the Ten Commandments, if that is the covenant, well, then we have to understand him as saying even the Decalogue, shudder the thought, even the Decalogue has been abolished. Well, it brings us to the next point, and that we have exact statements like that. The moral law is abolished. Look, for example, at 2 Corinthians chapter 3. 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Paul says here in verse 6, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, that God has made us ministers, able ministers of the new covenant. This is 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 6. God has made us able ministers of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter killeth, but the Spirit gives life. Now, what does he mean by the old covenant then, by contrast? Verse 7, if the ministration of death, written and engraven in stones, was glorious. Now, what do you suppose he means by written and engraven in stones? What is he referring to? He's referring to this, the moral law, the Decalogue. And yet he's speaking of that in the past tense. And in fact, we get in verse 11, it says, if that which is done away was glorious. Verse 13 at the end, that which is abolished, katargeo, done away. It's in specific reference to the moral law, so-called, that Paul says it's abolished. Now, you'll find that again I'm sure you're familiar with it. We don't need to take time to turn to it. In Colossians chapter 2, he speaks of the handwriting of ordinances against us. He speaks of the Sabbath, which must not be enjoined upon the new covenant believer. That's right here, the moral law. We have the same thing in Galatians chapter 4, verses 9 through 11, where Paul says, "You're observing Sabbaths. I wonder if all of my work's been in vain for you." Specific reference to the moral law. You have the same thing in Romans chapter 14, where they're observing holy days. And Paul says that's the weaker brother doing that. Again, it's in reference to the moral law that Paul says it is abolished. Now, having said all of that, we have to come to some kind of a good conclusion. The point that arrives from all of that is not that idolatry, murder, theft, adultery is no longer wrong. Obviously, we're not saying that. What it does tell us is that Moses' law, as Moses' law, is no longer. This codification of the law of God has been displaced. In other words, then, it's wrong, incorrect. Let's make it a little milder. It's incorrect for the new covenant believer to look to Moses' law or any part of it for his rule of life. It's wrong to look to the whole of it or to any part for our direction. It has been displaced. It's been abolished. Now then, that brings the next question. It's very important, and that is the question of law today. Is there a law for today? Well, covenant theology, of course, answers yes, there is law today. It's this right here, the moral law. But that suffers from the problems we've just been looking at. Dispensationalism, on the other hand, has difficulty, or at least traditionally has had difficulty, acknowledging any kind of law as binding upon the new covenant believer. Under grace, they would argue, we're no longer under any kind of law. Well, the difficulty with that teaching, it seems, is the clear presence in the apostolic of writings of so many scores of imperatives, so many scores of commands. And in fact, even explicit references to law. In fact, sin itself in the New Testament is defined as anomia, lawlessness. And in the New Covenant, the law is written on the heart, but it's law nonetheless. So it seems to me that it's very clear that the Christian is given a law, a rule of life to which he is obliged. Now then, in those passages when Paul argues that the believer is not under law, the meaning then would not be that the believer today is left without a rule of life. He's not saying that at all. He may be saying at times that the believer is free from the law as a means of justification. The law can't condemn him. He may be saying that the law, or that the believer today is free from the law of Moses. But he's not implying that the believer today has no rule of life to follow. Now, in answer to that problem, dispensationalists traditionally have argued that these requirements are gracious rather than legal, and so they're not really law at all. By that, what they mean is the new covenant believer is made willing to obey God. Therefore, it's not law. But that seems to me to be very, very difficult. How can willingness to comply with the stated demands somehow nullify the obligatory character of the demand itself? It's still law. For example, I have a little boy. He loves dearly. His favorite thing to do is to help Daddy. If I said, "Jimmy, let's go out in the front yard, dig a hole, we're going to plant a bush," he would be delighted. He'd be thrilled to death to help me. And so he would. Well, he'd call it help. It really wouldn't be that much help. He's too little to be of much help. But anyway, I command him to do it, and I tell him to come out. Now, he wants to do it. Does that in any way nullify the obligatory character of the command that I've just issued? It doesn't at all. He may be willing, he may not be willing, but he'd better obey. It's still law, no matter how willing. Seems to me that this overlooks something, too, at this point. I mean, if we're honest with ourselves, we have to admit that when we're faced with the New Testament demands upon us, sometimes we're not too willing. That just seems to be a fact of the matter. I know that's true of most of you anyway. It happens on occasion. And then you're faced with a demand. Is it obligatory or isn't it? Well, if willingness does not nullify obligation, once we acknowledge the obligatory nature of God's law, we thereby admit law. Once we say, all right, there are some demands that are obligatory, we are admitting that there is law to which we are obliged. It's demanded of us. Now, Chafer claimed that the commandments of Christ really were not commands after all, but the teachings of grace. When the New Testament issues commands to you, he said, it's not really a commandment after all, it's the teachings of grace. That seems to me to reduce law to advice and commands to suggestions. God doesn't just give advice. When he reveals his will, that will carries the force of law, no matter how gracious the context. McLean argued that the standard of conduct for the believer today is not law at all, but the example of Jesus. But that begs the question, you see. Because if there's any standard at all to which we are obliged, that standard has the force of law. And we're obliged to keep it. Now, others have argued, and McLean was among them, that since there are no penalties stated in the New Testament, it follows that there are no laws. And of course, what he's building on is all of these penalties that were stated in the Old Covenant for disobedience, we don't have any of them stated for today. It seems to me to suffer from a couple of problems. Number one, there is a penalty stated. Hebrews chapter 12 deals very plainly with the chastening of the believer for disobedience. Now, that doesn't have the penal character of the inflictions and punishments of the Mosaic law. But you see, for someone who's not under the Mosaic law at all, Mosaic penalties aren't necessary. And so it's not the same kind of punishment, but the fact of chastisement for disobedience remains. Well, in conclusion then, the believer today indeed has a rule of life. As was the case before and during the Mosaic economy, all men are bound to a divine standard of righteousness. Just as divine law against idolatry, murder, theft was in effect before Moses, so it is in effect after Moses. And the formula of Concord, I think, was exactly right. Although it confused the law of God with the law of Moses, it was right in saying that the law of God is today a certain rule after which regenerate men may and ought to shape their lives. The law of God, without formal codification or with formal codification, reflects eternal principles of righteousness which are always obligatory on everyone. It could never be anything less. Now, the question that comes up next then is, if there is law today for today's believer and it's not Moses, well, then what law is it? What is the identity of the law for believers today? In a series of articles in Bib Sac in 1959 through 63, Aldrich argued in favor of a distinction between Moses' law and the law of God, but then he came back around and identified the law of God with the Decalogue. They are one and the same. I don't think there's any support for that. I don't think we can make that equation. That is, in another way, the same thing that covenant theology does. Equates the law of God with the Decalogue. Well, it seems that if the law of God was codified at Sinai into the terms of the new covenant, and if the Mosaic covenant has now been set aside and has been replaced with the new covenant, it would seem we would expect that the law of God now has been recodified into the terms of the new covenant. And that, I think, is where we have to come. The believer's standard of conduct today are the demands of the New Testament. If the old covenant is abolished, it seems to me to be wrong to impose it as a rule of life for today. If we're new covenant believers, it only seems reasonable that we should look to the new covenant for our rule of life. Now then, when the New Testament writers declare that the old covenant, the old law, is abolished, again, it seems to be a questionable hermeneutic which says, well, parts of it are abolished and parts aren't. Now, part of the problem with that, the reason they come up with it, is, of course, they see some similarity of law from the old into the new dispensation. For instance, is idolatry still wrong? Well, of course it is. Is murder still wrong? Of course. Adultery, theft, covetousness, these things are still wrong. Now, what covenant theology has done is said, well, you see, you have at least 9 of these 10 words reiterated in the New Testament, and that's their proof that this whole section of Moses remains. What I'm arguing is, when we see similarity from the old to the new, it doesn't necessitate the conclusion that one's part or one section of Moses is carried over. It simply proves continuance of laws, not continuance of a particular segment of Moses' law. It simply proves that there's overlap. And we would expect overlap, wouldn't we? Because the old covenant, Moses' covenant, is a codification of the law of God. If the new covenant is a recodification of the law of God, there's that same basic law undergirding both, and we would expect similarity. And so we find it. But that similarity, when it's observed, does not prove continuance of a particular segment of Moses. It proves overlap of laws, and that's all. Now then, it was argued earlier that the threefold division of Moses was artificial. It was not exegetically justifiable. What I'm arguing here, though, renders the very debate irrelevant, because even if these divisions of Moses' law were able to be shown, the fact remains that the old covenant is not the standard for a new covenant believer. Now, does that fit the data? Well, I think it does. For example, when the New Testament tells us that we are not under law, again, it may be telling us that we are not under law in the sense of condemnation. It may tell us we are not under the Mosaic law. And when it says that Moses is abolished, we can do full justice to those statements, and we can give them full weight, and we don't have to worry about what part of Moses is carried over and what isn't. We don't have to wiggle at those points. We are very comfortable with any statement of discontinuity. Because in a system that doesn't need continuity, whatever points of continuity or discontinuity you observe really are not the point. Well, what we come down to, well, another one, for example, it has been a puzzling observation for virtually everyone who studied the Bible at one point or another, why only 9 of the 10 words are clearly reiterated in the New Testament. Well, in our system, I say our, I'm assuming a lot, I'm assuming you're in agreement. In this system, exact parallel isn't necessary, and so the observation really isn't all that puzzling after all. I don't need complete continuity. And so when I observe 9 of the 10 commandments reiterated in the New Testament, I say, fine, okay, the 9 of the 10 commandments are still binding. But you see, it's statement within the framework of the new covenant that evidences its continuance. Not my hermeneutic, which demands a section of Moses to be carried over. It is New Testament statement, not the demands of my hermeneutical system. Now let's go to some passages where I think teach this. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 19, I think, alludes to it. Very interesting here. Paul says in the New American Standard Bible, it reads like this: circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. But what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Now, circumcision was clearly a requirement of the law of Moses. But Paul plainly discards it as meaningless, as unnecessary. He says what does matter is keeping the law of God. Now, what this does for us then is it demonstrates, first of all, a distinction between the law of God and the law of Moses. And then it also tells us that today's believer is responsible to a standard other than Moses. So all of it seems to be implied in that one statement. Look over again at Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 12. Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 12. For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. Seems to me to be saying just exactly what I'm trying to say, and that is, since Christ has come, he has brought a new law with him. We know a new law has come because we have a new priesthood. If there is a new priesthood, there must of necessity be a new law. And it's precisely what we're arguing. Now let's go to Matthew chapter 5, and this one is a bit more complex than I think any of the other passages. And I may not satisfy you on this, but I think this works exactly in the direction that we're going as well. Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 21, where Jesus says, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am come not to destroy, but to fulfill. For I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." I'm sure you're familiar with the traditional covenant theology, their interpretation of this passage. Basically, they're saying what Jesus is doing here is expanding on the moral law. He is filling it full with its spiritual connotations. It is basically the moral law of Moses that Jesus is expounding in the Sermon on the Mount. I don't think that can be in view here, for first of all, because it doesn't do justice to verse 18, where Jesus speaks of the jot and tittle of the law. He's speaking of every detail. Furthermore, when we go through this sermon in chapter 5 particularly, we have reference to certain of what they would call the civil laws, like divorce, the lex talionis. These things are mentioned here. It's not just moral law that he's talking about. And first of all, that argument assumes that that distinction can be shown and that it was known in Jesus' day, an assumption I don't think they can show. I don't think that interpretation does justice to the passage. Now, an alternative view, which Doug Moo has put out, if you are familiar with the book Continuity, Discontinuity, Essays in Honor of S. Lewis Johnson, he has a chapter in there entitled The Law of Christ or the Law of Moses. And what he suggests there is that the teaching of Jesus, as we have it here in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, fulfills and even surpasses the law of Moses. And he goes into a study showing what fulfill in Matthew means, and basically it means anything what the old covenant pointed to. And so what he's saying here is that it is Jesus' law that Jesus is referring to that is binding. Now then, look at verse 19 again. What is the identity of these least commandments? Well, I think if we can go to the end of the sermon, I think we have Jesus identifying these least commandments in chapter 7 and verse 24 and verse 26. He speaks of these sayings of mine. I think he is coming and offering his teaching as law. And this is what is the standard of righteousness for the people of his kingdom. Moo says that this conclusion is in keeping with Jesus' general approach to the Old Testament. It is clear from, one, the relatively few number of times he cites the Old Testament as substantiation of his demands. Number two, it's clear from the implications of statements such as the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. And then finally, from the fact that it is Jesus' teaching that his disciples are to convey in their missionary enterprise. They are not told to go out and bring the moral law of Moses. He says, you go out and teach them whatsoever things I have commanded you. It seems that Jesus has come, he's offered his law, and he says, this is the ultimate standard of righteousness. It surpasses even Moses. It seems, again, that this is Jesus' very point in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, when we get to the end of the sermon in chapter 7 and verse 23, Jesus identifies those who disobey this teaching of his as those who work iniquity, anomia, lawlessness. In other words, then, I think we should see that in terms of Matthew chapter 11, verse 29, Jesus' yoke, take my yoke upon you. They would understand that in terms of teaching, law. And when we read in Galatians 6, 2 of the law of Christ, I think we need to understand it the same way, that Christ has come and given his law, And that is the ultimate standard of righteousness. We're running out of time. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 20 and 21, I think Paul summarizes the point exactly. Paul there says, when I'm with the Gentiles, I am not under law. When I'm with the Jews, on the other hand, I can be as one who is under law. But you see, he's saying, I'm not obliged in either case. I'm free. But not to be misunderstood, he says, that is not to say I'm without law altogether. I am enomos Christou. I am subject to the law of Christ. And that is the translation that Bagg gives. Subject to the law of Christ. Well, there Paul is clear on both scores. Number one, he's not obliged to the law of Moses. And number two, he is obliged to the law of Christ. Well, what it comes down to then, I think, is that the issue is one of lordship. Jesus' law stands above all others as the ultimate standard of righteousness. Moses prophesied the same. A prophet is to come after me, will be greater than me, and he'll function in the sense in the same way I did when I was at Sinai. He'll bring you a law, and you had better hear him, because if you don't hear him, the Lord will require it of you. Isaiah echoed that same thing in the first of the servant songs in Isaiah chapter 42. He spoke of Christ coming with terms like coming to bring judgment, mishpat, and the isles waiting for his Torah. He comes and the Father announces from heaven, this is my beloved Son, hear him. And you just have to see it as fulfilling that what Moses predicted. Again, it seems to echo with what we saw in Hebrews chapter 7, that Christ has come and brought with him a new law. Well then, when we look at the law of Moses and the law of Christ, we'll find some differences and we'll find some similarities. We'll find that because the basis of each is the same, but the details are different, and that's to be expected because we have a recodification of the law of God into a covenant relationship binding on those people within that covenant. A word of clarification quickly. When I say the law of Christ, I'm not speaking only of the exact words of Jesus. I think we have to extend that to his apostles as well. They function as the foundation of the church in that sense. Jesus says, I have many things to teach you. You can't bear them now, but I'm sending the Spirit to give them to you. And I think that's an extension of the law of Christ. In other words, it is the framework of the new covenant that gives us our standard. This matter of the function of the law of Christ, I didn't think I would be able to get to. That will be another time. In summary, the law of God is always binding, and it could never be anything else. But it has been codified in various ways, and the new covenant then expresses the law of God for believers today. Now, this seems to me to be very clean and simple, because there are some details that we have to contend with. The dilemma that faces the interpreter is that on the one hand, Moses is declared abolished. On the other hand, we have similarity to some of Moses' law that are still binding in this day. I don't have to wiggle and explain why the Sabbath, for example, is not enforced in the New Covenant. I don't need any kind of continuity. I can go to the New Covenant and find a sufficient guide for life, and that's all I need. So law there is, and it's a necessary rule of life, but that law should not be viewed as Mosaic because that law has been abolished. Several implications which really we are not able to get to either. I think I'm out of time.